and it's 1984. Well, that's it for today's show. I hope you found it enlightening.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of education leadership at UW Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Mangi. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD-HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm your host this morning, Steve Brown. In segment one, my guest will be Ron Martin, who is president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, also known as WEAC, and we'll be talking about what's happening around the state post Act 10, and we'll be talking about some other topics. In segment two, a replay of a program we aired earlier this year in January, and that'll be with Kathy Kohlmeier Frey, whose U.S. Supreme Court case of Hazelwood versus Kohlmeier is celebrating the 30th anniversary, and this was a case dealing with the rights of students in terms of free press with student newspapers. And joining Kathy will be Dr. Dan Weddle, who is professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And my guest in segment one here on Education Matters is Ron Martin. And Ron is president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, also known as WEAC. And also, Ron is best known around the state as Duff Martin. And Duff is a teacher of social studies in the Eau Claire School District. And he's just started his third year as president of WEAC. Duff, welcome to Education Matters.
Well, thanks, and thanks for having me.
First of all, give us some background about yourself in terms of your education, where you grew up.
Sure. I grew up in the way northern part of the state up near Hayward, Wisconsin, in a little town called Frog Creek. Not many people know it, population of 40. I attended high school at Northwood High School in Minong, Wisconsin, where I graduated and went on to college at Carthage in Kenosha. Mm-hmm. I did 2 years at Carthage. I transferred to UW Eau Claire so that I could be closer to home and my grandmother, who was very, very sick, and I wanted to be able to go see her whenever possible. And I graduated from UW Eau Claire, was successful in getting a teaching job in the Eau Claire Area School District, and that's where I've made my home for the last, 20-some plus years.
Wow. One of the questions, Duff, that I always like to ask guests, and I've asked numerous guests over the years that I've been hosting Education Matters, as you look back at your days in public school, is there one particular teacher who stands out as someone who really had a great impact on you as an individual?
Steve, I love that question because there is one teacher that stands out in my memory as somebody who had a huge impact on me, and that would be Mrs. Hennessy. When I was younger, we all called her Mrs. A because she was Mrs. Anderson. She was my elementary Phi Ed teacher, high school health teacher. But in the middle of me going from middle school or elementary to high school, she remarried Mr. Hennessy, our eighth grade science teacher. And she just was one of those individuals that really looked out for all kids and made all kids feel like they really valued, that they were very important. She's the one that really encouraged me to pursue my dream of becoming a teacher. And so she will always stand out as somebody who is very important and very special to me.
I notice also that you're involved with a program called Where Everybody Belongs. Maybe share some information about that program.
Sure. That's a middle school program that's part of the transitioning from the first year into middle school using your last year of middle schoolers. So it's a summer program, an orientation program to help our sixth graders feel more comfortable. And so I would select eighth graders to serve as guides and leads for groups of sixth graders, and it was just a really fantastic and a great opportunity for eighth graders to demonstrate their leadership skills, positive attitudes, and a welcoming and warm heart to the incoming sixth graders, who oftentimes are very scared, and it's just a whole different environment the middle school is compared to the elementary. So it's a great program to work with really very positive eighth grade leaders. And I saw them grow and just become such outstanding leaders in our school. It's an exciting program. The equivalent at the high school is called Link, and that helps the ninth graders transition into the high school, where they have 11th and 12th graders guide them through the process. In this day and age, where mental health is so important, and that we deal with that in our schools, these are just two types of programs that schools can implement at a fairly inexpensive cost to help with transitions, to deal with some of the nervousness. They really are outstanding programs.
Sure. And, this month, and this program will air this coming Saturday, as you know, October is National Anti-Bullying Month around the country. And a new survey has just come out, and the headline is, "New survey shows a majority of U.S. teens experience cyberbullying, and parents are the only adults perceived to be helping." As you look at your role as a teacher and then also as president of WEAC, and I want to talk more about WEAC and membership and how all that is going, but what have been your experiences as a teacher in your district in terms of cyberbullying and the kinds of programs that are in place in your district and programs that you're aware of that perhaps even WEAC is involved in?
Right. It's concerning to all of us, because that's the hardest for us as educators to deal with, because so much of that happens out of view from what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And unless kids are talking about it, or unless we see it ourselves, not many kids talk about that, particularly my experiences in the middle school with eighth graders. Very few kids come forward to, if you will, tattle on their classmates about the kinds of things that are being said and done in the world of the cyberspace. But it is something that we as an organization have embraced as far as our Bully Free, It's Up to Me. It's a kind of a curriculum program developed out of the National Education Association. Mm-hmm. So every time we have events where we do some training, we always offer that as one of the opportunities for our educators to engage in. We've also partnered with GSafe out of the Madison area, and that's a program that's organization that works with LGBTQ questioning youth. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to help address and train some of our educators on how to identify, how to work with, and how to do some solving of some of this cyberbullying that's going on. Because, as you said, it is a concern. All bullying is a concern to educators, and we certainly are hoping we can get rid of any kind of bullying in our schools.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Wisconsin Education Association Council, or WEAC, in terms of the role that WEAC is now playing in the state post-Act 10. And also, I'll mention a new study that just came out, which I'm sure you saw. It came out today, the results from WILL, W-I-L-L, that talks about Act 10. The headline is Act 10 Led to Improved Test Scores, and I want to talk about that. And as a researcher myself, I'll have some questions and some comments. As you look at your role now as president, and you've just started your third year as president, what do you see right now as the biggest challenges for public education here in Wisconsin, in particular in your role as president of WEAC, which over the years has had such an enormous impact on public education?
I think one of the biggest issues that we have identified, not only through talking with our members, but through some different polling we've done, is educator morale. It's been a huge issue. People are not feeling valued as educators. They're not enjoying the work they do. They don't feel that their opinions or their voice is being valued as professionals. So that's a huge concern to us. And DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, last year did a poll with all the licensed educators in the state of Wisconsin. And I don't have those poll numbers in front of me, but it was alarming to hear the number of people that considered leaving the teaching profession, because it wasn't just like a quarter of our educators. It was well over 50%. And that's really concerning, that individuals don't want to choose teaching or being in education as a lifetime career. I went into it as a lifetime career. I never went into it to become wealthy. I never went into it to become famous. I went in it because I knew the power and the value of public education. And so what we're trying to do at WEAC is to work with educators to help them boost the morale. We're trying to implement programs, opportunities for educators to get together, to learn to use their voice collectively. You know, we lost the right to bargain by law, but that doesn't mean we can't advocate collectively as a group for things that we believe are important, particularly things centered around child success, because we absolutely believe that every child, no matter where they live in this state, no matter their zip code, no matter their socioeconomic background or the color of their skin, absolutely deserve the right to a great public education. So as long as we keep that at the forefront, of which we've been able to do successfully as an organization, we're on the right track.
Sure. Duff, as we look at post Act 10 and since the 2011-12 school year, Act 10 has been in place essentially, what positive changes have you seen with regards to post Act 10, and also the other side of the coin, negative changes with regards to Act 10?
Sure. Well, I think some of the positive things that we've seen as an organization is we certainly have a very engaged membership. We have individuals that are actually engaged, involved, and are participating in democracy, participating in making sure that educators have a voice. And so one of the things that we've really focused on since Act 10 is the power lies within the school district, and particularly the school boards. You've mentioned that, you know, you're a member of a school board. The power of being able to collaborate and work so that that community has the best public school possible, that is what I've seen has been a very positive for us as an organization. I think for me, the negative has been the fear that I've seen in educators who are afraid to speak up when they see that something's not right. When they see that perhaps a particular situation in their school, their building, isn't being handled properly, and they want to be able to go to somebody with that, but they're fearful. The other that kind of correlates with that is the number of rural school districts, particularly in the northern part of the state, and I'm sure it's all over, but I know firsthand in the northern part of the state, there are districts that are not able to staff for certain teaching positions. They're just not able to attract, particularly in the hard-to-staff areas, science and math. Districts that are larger and have a little more resources are able to pay these teachers some more and offer other things that might be attractive to teachers that the little districts aren't able to do.
Sure.
So I see, you know, those as being some negatives since Act 10.
And you know, one of the things, you know, and certainly another area is special education in terms of staffing in special ed. Sort of a sidebar question, the WEA Academy and the kinds of programs that are done through WEA Academy. Maybe if you could talk a bit about that, and maybe how is that helping in some of the things that you just talked about?
Sure. Our WEA Academy has really been a powerful force for our educators to be able to advance themselves, not only in their career, but to help them become better educators in different areas. So our WEA Academy offers courses as well as micro-credentialing. Now, micro-credentialing is fairly new for the world of education, but not new for a lot of other job areas. But in education, we've really focused on just coursework, where you attain, you know, credits and move up on the salary schedule. Well, the micro-credentialing has really been a hit with our educators, and it's an opportunity for them to focus in on a specific area that will help them grow and be better, and they can use it as part of their teacher evaluation. They can use it as part of their resume if they're choosing to go to a different district. So it's pretty exciting, this micro-credentialing. It's pretty intense. It's vetted nationwide by a group of educators, so the courses aren't just willy-nilly. They are actually vetted by a group of educators. And then, of course, the coursework is still very popular, and this is just a great opportunity for our members at no cost or very little cost to be able to advance themselves in their career.
Mm-hmm. Sort of an additional question. Last year, Act 59 passed in the state and was signed by the governor, and which basically is referred to as the Lifetime Teacher's License or Licensure Program. What's your opinion as a teacher, and then what's WEAC's position on lifetime licensing?
I really struggled with this because on the one hand, there's so much on teachers' plates that, you know, if you take one thing off, now we can really focus on some of the other things that we're mandated or required to do. However, in my situation where I teach, the opportunity and the requirements kind of forced me to go out there and get additional credits and coursework so that I could maintain my license, because these were things that I knew my district just couldn't afford or offer because it was just too expensive. And so I had to make sure I was responsible for advancing my career and my professionalism. WEAC's position on this whole thing was we were really caught off guard on this particular provision, mm-hmm. and partly because we were never talked to. I mean, you would think perhaps if you're going to recommend something for all educators in the state, you would want to talk to the state's largest labor union that represents educators, but that didn't happen. So, you know, we're real concerned about it. We do know it was popular with some of our members because they thought there was going to be a savings. But on the other hand, they didn't realize what they would be missing out, because most districts, because they're not properly funded, cannot offer the PD that an individual can get through coursework. Mm-hmm. It's one of those that's a very difficult issue. We let our members speak, and a good majority of our members spoke very loudly in opposition to it. We did register against it. We didn't work real hard at advocating against it because we knew it was popular amongst some of our members.
In summary, Duff, let me ask you this. As you look back at the last 2 years and several months now that you've been president, what is one thing that you would like to see happen in Wisconsin, which historically has always had and still does have some of the finest public schools, some of the finest public school teachers and educators in the country? What is one thing, if you could look into the Duff Martin crystal ball, that you would really like to see occur, say, over the next 5 years? I know that's a broad question, but I'm asking it anyway.
I absolutely love that question because I think about that often. If there were one thing, and I think the one thing that I would like to see happen is let's stop using our public schools and our kids as political pawns in this horrible game of politics. Hmm. It's gotten so bad and so ugly that, you know, we have people claiming to be the education governor, and we have people saying, oh, we've invested. And they're talking about, you know, studies like what Will's done. The reality is our schools need more. And our educators are working hard to make sure with what little resources they have to be the best that they can be for our kids. And so that's my dream, is that we stop using our kids as political pawns.
Mm-hmm. I would second that in a heartbeat. Duff Martin, I want to thank you for all the work that you do and what WEAC does. My guest in this segment has been Duff Martin, also known as Ron Martin, who's president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council. He's also an eighth grade social studies teacher in the Eau Claire School District, and he's into his third year as president of WEAC. Duff, thank you so much for your time. It is very much appreciated, and best of luck as you move into your third year.
All right, thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
We continue now with Education Matters here on WGTD-HD, and I'm your host this week, Steve Brown. In segment two, my guests are Kathy Kohlmeyer-Frey and also Professor Dan Weddle. Kathy Kohlmeyer-Frey is the person after whom the court case of Hazelwood versus Kohlmeyer is named, and this year is the 30th anniversary of that U.S. Supreme Court decision, and we'll be talking with Kathy, along with Professor Dan Weddle, who is professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And this program aired in January of this year, which is the 30th anniversary month of this court case of Hazelwood versus Kohlmeyer. We are recording this program on Saturday, the 13th of January of 2018. And I mention that for a particular reason, that it was 30 years ago to the date that one of the most important landmark U.S. Supreme Court cases was decided, and that's the case of the Hazelwood School District versus Colmeyer. And if you want to look it up if you want to do a Google search, it's a U.S. Supreme Court case 484 U.S. 260, and it was decided on January 13th of 1988. And I am very pleased to have as my guest here on Education Matters, Kathy Colmeyer Frye, who was the person after whom this case is named. And also joining us is Professor Dan Weddle, who's professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And I'll talk more about how the three of us initially got together and have done some work. Anyway, first of all, Kathy, congratulations on this being the 30th anniversary to the date of your case.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having us.
And Kathy, just out of curiosity, when you woke up this morning with this being the 13th of January of 2018, 30 years later, did it feel any different to you?
A little bit. I still wish that the outcome was different. So I think every day that, you know, or every anniversary of it, something that weighs on my mind of how it affected people across the country.
Let me also introduce formally Dan Weddle, who's professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Dan, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Steve.
Let me ask you this, Dan. As you look at this particular case of Hazelwood, and when you talk about it in any of your law courses that you teach at UMKC, how important has this case been in the overall framework with respect to First Amendment rights of students in our public schools?
Well, I think it's a very important case because it gives a great deal of control over content in school-sponsored publications, school-sponsored theatrical performances, et cetera. I find it, I'm a little torn because I'm a fairly staunch advocate of First Amendment rights and making sure that students growing up in our public schools are well acquainted with what their rights are and are prepared to exercise those rights without governmental interference as they enter adulthood. On the other hand, I'm a former school administrator, and so I'm somewhat sympathetic to that concern that something students say that bears the imprimatur of the school might be inappropriate
mm-hmm.
for the school. So I find myself sympathetic to the rationale of the majority in Colmeyer, but I'm also disturbed and cautioned by the minority's position, which suggests that this could be used to abuse student expression because the school can the school can certainly be encouraged to believe that it can censor anything with which it disagrees in a school-sponsored publication or some other forum. That's not what the court held. The court says there needs to be a legitimate pedagogical reason for censoring school-sponsored student expression. That does leave a lot of play for heavy-handed administrators who simply don't want a controversial statement out there that could be attributed to the school.
Just for our audience's background, and I'm just going to read a bit of the background, but then, Kathy, I'm going to turn it over to you because you lived this. You were obviously very actively involved in all this, but I'll just give some very basic background, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, and I'll ask you a very direct question about exactly what happened and basically, have you go through step by step, piece by piece, if you will. But anyway, on this day in 1988, on this date, I should say, January 13th of 1988, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in the case of Hazelwood School District versus Colmeyer. And by the way, for our audience, the Hazelwood School District district is in the suburban area of St. Louis. They held that students do not have a First Amendment right to publish a school newspaper free from school administrator editorial oversight. The Spectrum, which was the school newspaper and still is at Hazelwood East High School in Missouri, in a suburb of St. Louis, was written and edited by students. And the actual article was written back in May of 1983. And I'm going to stop right there. Kathy, give us the background of how things, what led up to the actual writing and put together, and putting together, rather, of those articles that dealt with teen pregnancy and divorce that appeared in that issue of the Spectrum back in the spring of 1983. And then also maybe share with us some background of those types of articles that appeared, I think, 5 or 6 years before.
Okay. During my junior year of high school, first semester, we were in class for Journalism 1, and we were learning what it was like to be a journalist. And I was very interested in that because I was a good writer and good kid all around, and just, you know, I enjoyed the class. So in second semester, we're now official journalists because we have passed Journalism 1, and we hold elections within the class, and we decide who's going to be hold what position with on the staff. And I was chosen to be the layout editor, so I got to design things because I also had a creative flair, still do. So our staff was, I guess, maybe a little bit different than what the typical previous staffs had been in the most recent years. And we wanted to do some stories that were a little more hard-hitting. We recognized some problems within our school. We had a very large teen pregnancy population and a large student body, but we recognized that that was an issue, and we wanted to identify that and talk about it and maybe change some students' minds. We also did stories on divorce, marriage, runaways, and we got these ideas from our morgue, where 5 to 6 years before that, underneath a different principal, the same story topics were run, but we wanted to put a new spin on it, and so that's exactly what we did. We updated things. We had the permission of our director, our advisor, Mr. Sturgis, and proceeded to do our research on everything. The staff interviewed different girls that were pregnant, three very different cases in point with them. One was excited about the pregnancy, one accepted the responsibility for it, and one thought it was just the worst thing that could possibly happen. And we discussed those things, what it was like for them going through that. We talked to the boyfriend. We talked to the parent. But most importantly, we got consent from everyone involved. So we had signatures to support. Once everything was written up, we went back and said, is this accurate? Did we do a good job? If so, please sign off on it. So we had the students as well as the parent approve what we had written to make sure for accuracy, because we were taught, well, it's important to be an accurate journalist because that's responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, let me interject with a question. Mr. Sturgis, how long had he been at the school?
Oh, many years. Teacher for quite some time.
Okay. So the role of the advisor, maybe describe for our audience who might not have a direct frame of reference for that. What role did Mr. Sturgis play, and how important was he in guiding all of you in terms of following good journalistic ethics?
He played an important role to us, just to direct us to make sure that we were being fair and accurate, that we covered our sources and responsibly quoted. That was one step further along with the pregnancy story. We also changed the names of everyone in it and left a blurb to start that with stating that we had changed names because he had taught us well. So he would come back and, you know, check to make sure that we were grammatically correct, that stories were just journalistically good. And he, as far as we know, everything was fine with everything going on with it. We had no idea that there would be a problem, but he did end up leaving, and we hadn't known, I guess being, you know, students, it's not his place to discuss it with us, that there had been some issues between him and the principal, Mr. Reynolds.
So, Kathy, you mentioned that Mr. Sturgis left You mentioned Mr. Reynolds, and who was a fairly new administrator at the school. Dan, by the way, as you're listening to this, just in general, what does that mean in terms of something having the imprimatur of the school or the school district?
Well, it means that it appears that the school is endorsing and supporting that particular piece of writing. For example, you often see disclaimers on various websites or other publications that the opinions expressed in this article are not necessarily the opinions of the editorial board or of the particular publication.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to allow contradictory opinions without making it sound as though, let's say, a newspaper itself is preaching the opinion of a George Will or preaching the opinion of a Maureen Dowd,
mm-hmm.
but simply allowing it to be expressed. In a school newspaper, of course, because it's so well, it's so heavily supervised typically by a journalism teacher, et cetera, the fear is that students and parents will assume that anything published in it is reflective of the position of the school. I'm not sure that how realistic that is, but that's the concern. So when it bears the imprimatur of the school, it's the reasonable belief by readers that the school itself is endorsing the point of view.
But Dan, as Kathy was talking about the background, I'm wondering if any questions came to mind for you in terms of something that you might like to ask her.
Actually, it did. Kathy, I was struck by the way the facts are portrayed by the case. And let me read part of it. Reynolds was concerned that a student identified by name in the divorce story had complained that her father, quote, wasn't spending enough time with my mom, my sister, and I, end quote, prior to the divorce, quote, was always out of town on business or out late playing cards with the guys and always argued about everything with her mother. Reynolds believed that the student's parents should have been given an opportunity to respond to these remarks or to consent to their publication. The court never challenges that characterization, but from what you're describing, it sounds as though, in fact, you did talk to the parents and you did give them an opportunity, certainly to consent to what was said. Is there some discrepancy between the facts as presented by the court and the facts as you remember them?
There are, and I think that goes back to the representation of Ms. Edwards. The parents were given a form to make sure that they were okay with it. My father was the alcoholic mentioned in the story, and actually before the paper was finalized, that particular name was removed.
Uh-huh.
So it's actually going to press.
Was your dad given the opportunity to respond to what you were saying? Or
he was indeed given an opportunity.
What strikes me here is that the facts as recited, Reynolds believed that students' parents should have been given an opportunity to respond to these remarks or to consent to their publication. The implication is that that had not been done when, in fact, it had. It's an interesting thing about cases many, many times, and we saw this with Morris v. Frederick, that the facts that actually reach the Supreme Court on the record may not be accurately reflective of what actually happened. On the record, the majority may pick and choose, maybe cherry-pick some of their facts, but it's an interesting phenomenon that I don't think most people understand, that the way trials work and the way the record goes up, the court might not actually know the real story. It's only working on what it thinks is the real story.
And I believe that to be very true, and I think that goes back to the presentation from Ms. Edwards, that she did not go over all of the facts well. She failed to talk about that the articles had been previously run underneath a different administration. So why was it okay several years before and not now underneath a new principal? She failed to mention that the names had been changed. So those kind of things were important that maybe that would have made differences had they been presented properly and had she been fully prepared, because throughout the testimony, her trial presentation to the justices, she bumbled her way through the majority of it, and it was a direct reflection on how the justices made their case.
Kathy, let's go back for a minute. You know, the role that Mr. Sturgis played, when Mr. Sturgis left, and I believe he left mid-year or thereabouts, the person who took his place, was this person qualified? That's question one. And what kinds of guidance and support did he give to all of you on the staff of the Spectrum?
Well, there were actually two people that came in. The first was just a substitute teacher that had no journalism background, and she was the one that was actually in the classroom with us day to day, so we had no direction provided from her. The other person they brought in was from another school within the district, and he was a journalism advisor, and they said it was his practice to take the finished articles to the principal for his review before they went to press. Now, based upon what we've been told by Sturgis, that was not ever how things were handled with him. So I think we kind of got off track on how things had been typically handled because of the turnover of advisors. But we had no regular interaction with the other advisor that came in.
Mm-hmm. After these articles were written in 1983, I'm talking about the new articles, if you will, are the ones that were part of this court case. What exactly happened? And maybe just talk to us briefly about the sequence of events once those articles were written and they were, for lack of a better term, handed into the new advisor who was there and who then followed his normal procedure that he used at his other school.
So when we finished production of it, they went to the new interim advisor. He took them to Mr. Reynolds, the principal. I guess there was conversation about the issue with Reynolds seeing the name at that point still, and the objections came up of that they disagreed with the stories. The paper went to press minus those two pages, came back the following school day, because it started over the weekend. We were to sell the paper on that Monday, and when we got the paper back, it was missing those two pages. No conversation was had with us saying, hey, there was a problem. Here's an opportunity to fix anything that was a concern. Two pages just were never printed. At that time, we went down to talk to Mr. Reynolds and to question where were the other two pages, because that was really the lead of the paper, for better words, and he said that it was not going to be printed, basically because they were all trash, and nothing was good journalism about them. He also went on to say that throughout our conversations, we said, you know, what specifically? He said, well, you know, you can't be talking about these kind of things, pregnancy to students. He said, it's too mature for an immature audience, and I questioned him and said, if you're old enough to get pregnant, shouldn't you be old enough to read about it? And that didn't go over particularly well with him. He went on to say that if we did not sell the paper as it stood, then there would not be a senior edition, and that was accolades to the graduating seniors, and there were more seniors in the class than juniors. So he told us we could take a vote and decide. And because of the fact that there were more seniors than juniors, they won out. The paper was sold as it stood. Those of us that were not in favor of it did not participate in selling the paper. We went back up and discussed what our next action plan would be because we felt very strongly about it. I went over into the library where we had an actual phone that we could get in touch with Sturgis, and I made a phone call to Mr. Sturgis, and I told him what had just happened and asked for his opinion of what we needed to do, because we felt that after having had Journalism 1, learning about prior restraint and the Tinker Standard, that we had been censored, our rights had been violated. He advised me at that time to contact the American Civil Liberties Union, which I went back to the class and told the ones that were still within the class, this is what Sturgis said. And he was the kind of advisor that you really trusted. The kids had a very good relationship with him, and we believed in everything that the man said to be good. So we went home that night, talked to our parents about it. Those parents that were supportive of it said, fine, do what you guys need to do. Those are the other ones that were concerned about possibly not graduating just because of, you know, it was very near to graduation. They didn't follow through with it, but we, group of us, did go to the ACLU. We did have a conversation with them, and they were in agreement that censorship had occurred, and they decided to follow it and make it a case.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any sense that Mr. Reynolds had actually read the articles?
I had thought so up until that day, because he had, you know, made the comment that they were trash, and then during that time at UMKC, when he said that, well, it was all just a budget reason that we didn't have the money for it, and he had never actually read the articles, there was an audible gasp within that entire very large room full of many people. I don't ever, honestly, to this day, know if he read them or not, because he has now talked out of both sides of his mouth.
In the majority opinion, right towards the end, right in the opinion, I'll just quote this. It says that Principal Reynolds testified credibly at trial that at the time that he reviewed the proofs at the May 13th issue during an extended telephone conversation with Emerson, he believed that there was no time to make any changes in the articles and that the newspaper had to be printed immediately or not at all. It is true that Reynolds did not verify whether the necessary modifications could still have been made in the articles and that Emerson did not volunteer the information that printing could be delayed until the changes were made. And, you know, and when I read that, and I read that over like three different times in the last couple of days in preparation for this interview, and knowing, Kathy, what you had said before, and again reiterating what you just said today in this interview, that, you know, here's the principal saying to you that he hadn't even read the articles. So again, Dan, that goes back to what you said, what was or wasn't said in the Eighth Circuit Court in their decision, and what actually happened.
Well, that's exactly right, and I think here what we're seeing is poor presentation at trial, poor presentation of evidence, resulting in a bad result for the parties.
The final thing I wanted to ask you, Kathy, after 30 years now, as you look back, my two very quick questions for you. Number one, how has this case affected your life? And the second question, what impact has it had on your family?
Well, it's had a large impact on me as far as how I believe things, how I've raised my children. And so I can kind of, I think I'll actually bring this into one question. But it's given me the opportunity to travel the country, to talk to educators, to talk to students, just people with an interest in journalism, and tell my story about it. But most importantly, it's allowed me to be part of the New Voices Act of USA, to talk to legislatures about how important it is to reconsider this decision. Many states are now passing laws to basically restore the rights to student journalists, and is a very active movement in the country to get those rights wronged for future students and current students. But it's also made me the kind of person that I will speak up for things that I disagree with. It's also modeled my children into being that type of person as well.
I want to thank both of you, Kathy Kohlmeyer-Frey and Dan Weddle. Dan, who's a professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and Kathy Kohlmeyer-Frey, who still lives in Missouri. And her case of Hazelwood School District versus Kohlmeyer. And this was a landmark court decision of the U.S. Supreme Court that held that public school curriculum student newspapers that have not been established as a forum for student expression are subject to a lower level of First Amendment protection than independent student expression or newspapers established as forums for student expression. That decision was handed down on January 13th of 1988. I'm Steve Brown, your host this morning for Education Matters. Thank you for listening. My guests this morning were Duff Martin, president of WEAC, and in segment two, Kathy Kohlmeyer-Frey and Professor Dan Weddle. For Education Matters here on WGTD-HD, I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Hello, I'm Orson Welles. We know a remote farm in Warworth where Mrs. Buckley lives.